Okay, it's Friday, the end of another week, and the weekend, it goes fast, and it will continue to go fast as we watch the world unravel as it heads off into an entirely different direction. A direction, however, quite well planned and thought out of, seemingly nothingness, but thought out of an enormous universe of greed that goes back on this planet a long way. It's Harry Cooper night, and we get to talk to Harry about all kinds of things. We have some pictures up on the site for you to look at as well. But something happened in the Senate yesterday, and Charlotte Isherbeat asked if she could come on to tell all of you about what your government has just done to you and your children, and by extension, your grandchildren, if any of us are around to have grandchildren. And first, let's say hi to Harry. Hello, my friend. How are you?
Good evening. I'm doing great.
Yeah, glad to hear it. Okay, Charlotte, say hello to Harry. Charlotte Isherbeat.
Yeah. Hey, Harry. Hello.
Hi, Charlotte. I've heard a lot about you.
Jeff has told me a lot about you, and I want to thank you profusely for giving me this 15 minutes. It's very important, and I'm sorry to... There's nothing worse than somebody said to me tonight that I had to give up half of my time or whatever. I would not be happy. So I want to thank you profusely, Harry, and let's stay in touch.
Did you have a clue, Harry? Nobody knows this is going on.
Yeah. Let me add a little thought about the PTA. You struck a chord there. 20 years ago when my kids were little, I was PTA president. I didn't even know I was running to be PTA president, and I had a shark hunters group in South Africa, and I talked to my wife on the phone, and she told me they had elected me PTA president. Okay, that's fine. So, you know, the little local PTAs, you know, you control your own stuff. Well, I had heard that, this was 20 years ago, I think, I had heard that the PTA National was heavily funding to get the Brady Bill passed.
Oh, yeah. Well, what's that? Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I called the national office of the PTA, told them I was a local PTA president, and I wanted to talk to the national PTA president. Well, you can't. It's just an honorary title, I was told. So I said, well, who the hell's in charge of this thing? Oh, well, we have a chairman here, a CEO. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So it's a corporation. So I said, okay, let me talk to that person. Well, you can't. He's busy. Or she, I can't remember which. So I explained what the problem was, and they put me in contact with their one of their chief legal people.
Uh-huh.
Some woman, I don't even remember her name. Man, it was 20 years ago. So I voiced my concern. I said, what the hell are you doing? You know, we're paying dues to National PTA, and you're using it to pass gun legislation?
You're doing political lobbying that doesn't represent the majority of America, and it's more than wrong. What you discovered, you just said it clearly, it was a machine, a corporation. You discovered
right. The
new America.
Yeah, so I asked her, I said, what the hell do you... what has that got to do with education? And this woman, you know, you could tell she was caught, and she's hemming and hawing. She says, well, you know, we want to make our schools safer.
Oh, please.
Yeah, by outlawing guns. I said, are you nuts? I said, why don't you outlaw cars? That way nobody gets hit by a car. And she just pimbled and thought. So then I realized that they were a left-wing
right.
Political...
It's been going on for a long time, Harry, and you got a real close look at it. Anything to add, then we've got to take our break.
No, that's it. It just, you know, I tried to get us to pull out of the PTA and be a PTO, and didn't work. So I said, that's it. Goodbye. I quit as PTA president after a year and a half.
Well, you've seen it coming firsthand. A lot of us have, and it's here. And that vote, that bill is so evil, it really defies description. It's that bad. It's sci-fi. It's beyond. It's post-Orwellian. It's crazy.
George Orwell had it figured out.
Yeah, and it's just gone beyond him, though, the technology that they have to use now. All right, hold on. We're going to take our break, and then we will come back with Harry Cooper. Just a couple minutes. Okay, and welcome back. SharkHunters.com. Without question, one of the most unique and important organizations on the planet. It's real history. And we talk about education. And the stuff that they're feeding our children about World War II is nothing less than abject lies, distortions, and corruptions of reality. Wholesale lies, not partial. Wholesale. It runs the full range. It's a rainbow of disgust and deceit, and it will never stop. It's only going to get worse and worse and worse. And the attacks on people who try to present reality are evidence clear as a pane of glass as to who the enemy is and what their tactics are. It's really disgusting. When our children are literally brainwashed, womb to tomb, cradle to grave, and the first time you let your kids sit in front of a commercial television, they are being programmed against you. They are being programmed to reject you, to question you, to hate you. Now, there are a lot of wonderful families out there who get this, and I know that I had a child, and I realized it, thank God, and literally got rid of the television before the age of 1 year. It was probably 3/4 of a year. I got rid of it. I have yet to this day to have another television. 25 years ago. I won't touch it. I see the poison. I see the programming. I see the technology. And believe me, when they went to HD, there are things coming out of that machine into your mind to control it and influence it that you would never dream of. It's there. Not a joke. It's not just a little flat screen of entertainment. There's a lot of evil in there and in the movie theaters and in the pop culture. You look at the pop culture. I just put a story up yesterday of Obama giving the Muslim sign. There is only one God, and that God is Allah, holding up his index finger when he was around some other Muslims. You look at that, then you look at the three finger, the horns, that is the symbol that the Illuminati use. How many rock and roll stars, so-called, have we seen? Look it up. Giving the sign of Satan. Giving the Illuminati sign. The hand sign. Look it up. Do a search. You'll find video after video after video. And these people on video, in many cases, have actually said, in a matter-of-fact way, not a joke, I've sold my soul to the devil for popularity, money, and fame. It's easy to do. Everybody's got a price. So it's easy pickings for the devil or whoever it is. I'm going to skip this break. We're going to go right through. Harry, any other comments on this? Then we're going to get to our history part.
No, I'm just going to ask you a question. You said something about the devil sign of three fingers up. What are those three fingers?
Thumb, little finger, three middle fingers down. George Bush used to give it. They used to try to pass it off as University of Texas Longhorn sign. It's not.
Well, that's the thumb and the little finger.
That's right. Now, there's an index finger, too, I think. But anyway, let me look it up. Go ahead and take the break, Todd, if you still can. I'm going to look up, do two things real quick here. You still have that ability?
Well, I was going to say that the three fingers up, like the little finger, the index finger, and the thumb, we do that with my son all the time because he's special needs, and that's the sign language. If you put your little finger up, that's
hang loose, right?
Be no, cool. Little finger up means I, the letter I.
Oh, it's signing, of course,
I.
Of course,
that's
of
right.
course.
And then you put your thumb and your index finger up, it forms an L for love, and then if you put up your index finger and your little finger, that's U for you. So the three fingers up in sign language means I love you. And every time my son goes out the door, I give him three fingers up, tell him, God bless you, your daddy loves you. So I don't know if the other people have converted that into the devil sign, but in the sign language, that means...
They may well have.
In sign language, it means I love you.
Yeah, there are several signs. One is two hands. Here's a perfect picture of Hillary. Two middle fingers down, baby finger, pinky, and index straight up, and the thumb out. That's been co-opted.
Okay.
Okay. That is used now routinely by the darkest of the dark, and so they're mocking love.
Anything Hillary does, I think, has bad implications.
Yeah, I'll send this to you. There's so many of them out there, hundreds and hundreds of these. And it's they used to try and say, oh, it's Texas Longhorns. Then they gave that up when it became obvious that too many of them had affiliations with satanic and dark influences.
Yeah, and none of them had ever been to University of Texas.
No, they don't have that big of an alumni, that's for damn sure.
Hundreds of millions or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a big thing, and the young people think, oh, how cool it is. It's really sad.
Young people are easily led. I was young once, but I was easily led too, but I was easily led to go down to the Air Force recruiter at age 18, sign up, and be gone for 4 years in the Air Force. I don't regret that a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But now, people are looked down on if they join the military. And I think any man, any guy who is physically and mentally capable who does not join the military really isn't a real American. Hope I'm not stepping on any toes here, but...
Well, it's understood what you're talking about. That has pretty much gone by the boards, though. Things have changed so much in the last 30 years that people don't think that way anymore. There was a time when that was an absolute given. But not now.
It was longer than 30 years ago that I signed up. A lot longer than 30 years ago when I went into boot camp.
Yeah.
That was back when they were...
Well, and for those of you who don't know, Harry worked with nuclear warheads.
That was my career field.
Yep.
I was in command of a 6-man team loading thermonuclear weapons onto B-47 bombers.
Yeah.
In the armpit of America, Lincoln, Nebraska.
Was that a good plane?
Well, it was supposed to do the job, but they figured about 9 out of 10 would get knocked down by ATR stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever work on a B-36?
No, they were phasing out, but there was one in our hangar when we were training, and I remember they had four big long bomb bays, and they had kind of like a mechanic's creeper in a tube that went down the entire length of the aircraft alongside the bomb bays with little windows so that the bombardier could look in and check everything. And when the sergeant wasn't looking, I was up inside that bomb bay and about halfway down on the creeper, and then I'd go to sleep.
That was an amazing aircraft. I thought an extraordinarily unusual looking airplane.
It took an act of God to get that thing in the air.
It was in the movie Strategic Air Command, I believe. A lot of magnificent color movies of this aircraft.
Right, with Jimmy Stewart, because he was a Brigadier General in the Air Force. He flew combat.
World War II. Yeah, sure. So did Clark Gable. He was a photographer. He had a movie camera, and he would go up in these planes and shoot the action.
One of the movie stars from back then, Eddie Albert, he was a small boat skipper running guys and supplies in the Pacific onto the beachheads while they were in combat. Today, I bet you'd have a hard time naming any celebrities who were in the
military. No, I couldn't. And I'm amazed at how few of them, and there were some big names. The only big celebrity who died as a direct result of World War II activities that I can think of was Carol Lombard. When you think about it, married to Clark Gable.
Yeah.
Clark went in after she died, but she was on a war bond drive and was flying back. She's flying back from Las Vegas to Hollywood, and the plane was a Ford Trimotor, I believe. It wasn't high enough, and it hit that Red Rock Ridge. And that was the end, just in a second.
Yeah, well,
less than a second.
Times have changed, you know. When I was a kid, every morning we'd all file out in our little grade school out into the hall, and these two twin brothers played their coronets, the national anthem, and we would all sing the national anthem, and we all had our hand over our heart, pledged allegiance to the flag at the end of the hallway, and then we had a little prayer. Oh, God forbid you should do that nowadays. You might offend someone.
Oh, you would.
And of course, I have taken the position that I offend as many people as I can. I am
just a nasty guy. Doggone it.
Well, I'm so old, what are you going to do to me? Plus, in Florida, you don't dare hit an old person because it's a felony. And you go to prison for 5 years, lose your right to own guns, lose your right to vote. And the 5 years in prison, that's a pretty serious...
it's a life sentence for older people.
Yeah, but if anybody hits an old person, they go to prison for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. So I can be as obnoxious as I want to be. But it just comes naturally to me. I guess that's
You don't have to work hard on it, do you?
No. It's kind of natural, like all my moppy hair and my blue eyes. Anyhow. Incidentally, a little news flash here. You obviously, you know the book Hellstorm by Tom Goodrich.
Yeah.
Excellent book. And he came out with the DVD or the YouTube or whatever presentation online.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about 2 hours long. Have you seen it?
Mm-mm. It's good.
Well,
I don't have time. I wish I did.
Yeah, I don't have time either. I've clipped through it, but I just got an email about 3 hours ago from some of our people in Germany. They have just translated the entire film Hellstorm into German.
Oh, you're kidding me.
And did a voiceover.
That's a first. That's a shock. That's going to rock those people. That will shake them up.
As much as I travel Germany, the older people, they don't believe the propaganda crap, but they're afraid to say anything because their government kind of has laws in place to where you can't do much. The younger people are starting to say, hey, wait a minute. We don't believe all this stuff about how evil and mean we were. So they're starting to learn, too.
Mm-hmm.
And our book, Hitler in Argentina, is selling fairly well over there, but we're trying.
A lot of them have to be being imported to Germany, even if they're not in German. A lot of Germans are quite literate and can read in English.
Exactly, and as you know, every time I get a translator in Germany who's ready to do the translation, a week or two goes by, and all of a sudden I get an email. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't have time. I have to sort my sock drawer, and. One lady emailed me and said, I'm not afraid of anything. I'll translate the book. And so I emailed back and said, good. How much money do you want? And a week went by, and I got an email from her, and it said, as I told you, I'm not afraid of anybody, but I have children I have to worry about.
No, there you go. She was contacted.
Yeah. So I have a translator now. I know I'm going to get a phone call tomorrow after this broadcast, but I have a translator now in England who was a translator with the British Army, and so he's highly trained, highly qualified to translate into German. And then I'm going to have it proofed by a friend of mine who lives in Central America, who was born in Germany. His father was killed in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came to this country with his mother and went into the U.S. Army, and he was a translator, German translator. So we'll get her done. It's going to come out very shortly in Spanish. We've got it done in Spanish, and it's at the print shop now. It's already out in French, and it's selling quite well in English.
Terrific. Well, congratulations. Yeah.
It's the truth on how Hitler did not shoot himself, and Eva Braun did not take poison. They died in South America.
Of old age.
Yeah. Of course, Hitler a lot sooner than Eva Braun because her health was in pretty good shape. His health was pretty rocky.
Yeah.
Plus, there was a big age difference.
It's all there. It's all in the book.
Yep.
I hope you can avail yourself of a copy. Just click on Harry's name, go to the website. You can order it right up tonight. It's probably one of the most remarkable books of history, as they call it, that will ever be written, because it shatters one of the biggest lies of the whole 20th century.
You mentioned how if you don't march in lockstep with Big Brother, you get attacked.
Oh, yeah.
And you know the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, or as we call them, the Spitlickers. Boy, they unleashed a campaign against me, said that I was a Nazi, which I'm not. I'm a Republican, but that probably doesn't help my case. and that Shark Hunters is a general hate group. That's terrible. We don't even focus our hate on anybody, according to them. We just
the only hate I've seen comes out of the SPLC.
Yeah, I know. One of our members, who's also a good friend of mine, is a Jewish guy, and he said the jerk, his words, the jerk from the SPLC comes by his gym every week and drops off copies of their newsletter. He says as soon as the guy's out the door, the newsletters go right in the trash.
Well, they don't play games. They've got all the connections in the world they want. They've got a 400-pound female pit bull who does most of the hate writing and the attacking.
525 pounds.
Is that what the word is?
Oh, yeah. Have you seen a picture of her?
No.
I she's huge. 525-pound lesbian.
Well, what can I say? It's all there, folks, and the enemy is well known. 0.37% of the world's population. That's it. Those are all the people who call themselves Jewish. Now, of those people, many of them are good folks. It's
we've got a lot of Jewish members in Shark Hunters who don't believe the crap.
No. It's Zionism is not Judaism. Nothing to do with it. They use Judaism as a screen. They hide behind it, and they sacrifice Jews and people who are pious and honest and well-meaning. It's very sad. I never want to lump all people of any group, whether they be Protestant, Buddhist, or Jewish, together. That's very dangerous thinking. It's dishonest, and it's not true. So you have to just keep your mind open to understand the evil is there, and it is observable. And you just heard Charlotte Thompson Iserby, former senior policy advisor, Department of Education under the Reagan administration, tell us what the Senate, the treasonous, traitorous, treacherous Senate, has just passed. We'll call it 80-20. That bill, you heard her read it, and she read it fast. So you ought to really, if you're in the archives, go listen to that again. Listen to it twice. Listen to it and understand what she said, and then look at those two articles at the top. They're at the top of Rents. So take a look and just know that you are not in the hands of good, well-meaning, moral people. We are in the hands of darkness, and we are going to pay the price.
But that's not my area of expertise, so I sit back and listen to you guys. I don't have any input into that stuff, but like I say, when you said you get attacked, I just thought I would put
that out. I get attacked. I got attacked on April 24th, and
fortunately, I haven't been run into a ditch.
Yeah. Well, my mind was turned off somehow, and then those two guys in the pickup truck came to retrieve something. We don't know what. They weren't in there looking for my hat.
Maybe they were there to steal your wallet.
Yeah. No, they went right past me and just... Anyway. Whatever. All right. We have pictures. Look under Harry Cooper's name for photos. There's some really wild technology. As you know, the Germans were absolutely brilliant. And five more months, the war might have turned into a much longer and perhaps different ordeal. All right. Hold on. Back in a minute. Okay, welcome back. Talking to Harry Cooper on this Friday night. We get to talk to Harry once a month on the third Friday. He's the third Friday already?
Yeah, time flies when you're having fun.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, now, what we have like a small group of really interesting pictures that Harry has brought for us to share and look at. Very advanced technology. I mean, probably, I don't know how, what, 10 years? How would you figure back then?
Oh, they were, I don't know, kind of hard to figure, but they were so far ahead in certain areas, which ultimately benefited the U.S.
Air-to-air heat-seeking missiles, for example. And they were so close to really changing things.
Yeah.
And it would have been a whole different story.
Well, the submarines are my area of expertise, more or less. And if you look at photo one, that looks like it's right out of Jules Verne. And photo two is the same submarine in a dry dock. And I put a black circle around the part that you see out of the water in photo one.
Mm-hmm.
When you see a surfaced submarine, you're not seeing most of the boat. Most of the boat is still underwater. And this was the this was U-791, which was one of the experimental boats. They were using the hydrogen peroxide turbine developed by Professor Walter.
Mm-hmm.
And they would burn hydrogen peroxide. These were just experimental boats, the Type 17. They were small boats displacing 313 tons surface, 343 underwater, and the other one, the type, the 202, was a little bit smaller. But they were just designed as test beds for this Walter propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
And when the war, and they just gave up on it because it just didn't work. And after the war, some of these boats went over to the Brits, and they were experimenting with them, and they renamed one of them HMS Explorer, and the crew nicknamed it HMS Exploder for obvious reasons. Hydrogen peroxide is not friendly stuff. You buy it at your local Walgreens store, and your wife bleaches her hair with it or whatever. That's less than 1% concentrate.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff they were using was almost 100%, and it's extremely volatile. It gave great amount of power, but it was not controllable. It kept blowing up. And some of these experimental boats were making 26 knots underwater, which was incredible in those days, because the average submarine, American, British, German, whatever, Italian, 7 knots underwater, and that was cranking it to the max, and the batteries would only last for about an hour at that speed. Whereas these guys underwater were making 26 knots, but they were undependable. So they scuttled them. They had four of them in operation. They scuttled them, and they were raised again after the war was over. And like I say, some brought back to England. I think one was brought to the U.S., but the design was just scrapped because, they just didn't work. Well, now Germany, some years ago, came out with the AIP. Submarines, air independent propulsion. They can run their diesels at 1,000 feet down because they've got oxygen in tanks compressed, and they've got fuel bladders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess the NSA is jamming us here.
Somebody's having fun. Wow, did you do that? Oops, sounds like we lost him. You there, Harry? All right, we'll get him back. That beep beep was very interesting. Okay, let's go back to the pictures here and take another quick look. Just look under guests and look under Harry Cooper. Look for photos and click on there, and you'll be right in step with us. These two pictures, the first two, same basic boat, just an extraordinary design. Look at the aerodynamics and look at the long nose. I do see a difference in the superstructure at the top.
Okay, we're back on again. The NSA knocked me offline, or someone did. Anyhow, these...
What I want to do, pictures 1 and 2.
Right.
Take note that all you're seeing in picture 1 is the circled part of photo 2.
Right.
To give you an idea of how large these were and what was underneath, look at the bullet nose on that. That's the 26-knot version?
Right. Depending on which one of the variants, they ran anywhere from 19 knots to 26 knots underwater. In photo 2, it's the stern that's closest to the camera, right underneath the number 2. That's the stern.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Look at it the other way and you get it. Okay, you have to reverse your eye. I got it.
Exactly.
Now. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And these things were, like I say, they were incredibly quick, but undependable, and they were having breakdowns all the time. And they had a small diesel engine on board, which could move them at about 9 knots.
Like an auxiliary outboard or something.
Pretty much, pretty much. It was an auxiliary motor, 210 horsepower, which is nothing.
That's a zero.
Yeah, wow. the regular diesel boats, they had twin diesels of 2,200 horsepower each.
Uh-huh.
So, and when they designed the Type 21 and 23, which were the super boats, the electro boats, they had a an inverted figure eight hull. Let's see, I think we got that. Let me move this out of the way, and we'll get to... Ah, yes, there's number 3. Number 3 is a Type 21. And that, and 24 is the bow section of a Type 23. And the nose was the same on a 21 and a 23. The only difference was the 21 was an ocean-going boat of about 1,500 tons, 252 feet long, and the Type 23 was a coastal boat of about 250 tons.
That's almost a football field long.
Yeah, that's... yeah. And the Type 23 coastal boats did actually get into combat. The 21s... were almost ready, but then the war ended. Their hull was an inverted figure eight with the small circle at the bottom.
Hmm.
And that was originally intended to be the fuel tank for the hydrogen peroxide, which they called Oral. But when they decided this was unworkable, they just filled it with battery cells.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Type 21 and 23 had three times as much battery capacity as the old diesel-electric boats.
Hmm.
And they could actually go faster underwater than surfaced. The Type 21, for instance, which is photo 3, could make 16 knots surfaced, but it could make 18 knots submerged. And pretty much the same for the 23s. Now, the 23...
Was this work... Were any of these getting close to working on cavitation?
I don't think they had problems with it. I haven't heard anything.
Well, cavitation is the hyperspeed that some of the cavitating torpedoes can make now. It actually creates an air bubble, a gas bubble, around the torpedo, mm-hmm. and the torpedo moves through its own encapsulated bubble mm-hmm. of air through the water.
Yeah, and you're talking about the Russian Skval torpedo.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a 54-inch diameter as opposed to the standard 21-inch, and it's rocket-powered.
And that thing can really move.
Yeah, over 200 miles an hour, 200 knots in the water, because part of the rocket exhaust comes out through the nose, and it runs through a sheath of its own bubbles, and it runs about 200 knots.
Mm.
And there's no escaping it, but there's also no... unless there's something new has happened that we're not aware of, there was no guidance system.
It's aim and shoot.
Yeah,
aim and shoot.
And if you got it going in the right direction, the target's not going to get out of the way.
Boat number 3 has some piece across going horizontal in our eye, about 90 degrees across the bow, to the bow.
Yeah, those are the diving planes.
They are. They're up their wings, and they're...
Right.
I see.
There's only one of these boats left in the world. They built a few hundred of them. There's only one left in the world.
Hmm.
And that was one of the ones that was scuttled in Germany at the end of the war. They scuttled several hundred boats against Admiral Dönitz's orders. And the Allies found every one of them, raised them up and broke them up for scrap, except they couldn't, they never found U-2546, 2540, I'm sorry, 2540.
They actually found all of them and raised them?
Yeah, and broke them up for scrap. You know, there was shallow water. They sank them in the various river mouths, the fight.
Bays, river mouths.
Yeah, they went down in shallow water. But they never found 2540. And then in the middle 50s, when Germany was allowed a submarine navy again, somebody said, oh, wait, let's not build one. I know where we can find one. And they raised it, they cleaned it up, and them diesels started right up.
I'll be darned.
And it's on display right now, but it has been extensively modified. It was shortened up, smaller engines put into it, so it's not an ocean-going boat anymore. Because the world gets nervous when Germany has ocean-going submarine. They renamed it the U. Wilhelm Bauer, and Wilhelm Bauer was the father of the German submarines back many, many zillions of years ago.
What are we looking in picture five here, Harry?
Stand by one. Let me move this guy over. Number five, yep.
Looks like almost two boats.
Three. There's one way over underneath the ceiling.
Okay.
We heard a rumor when we were there in 1988, we heard a rumor that there was a ruined bunker in Hamburg with three Type 21s in it. And the experts were telling us, no, absolutely not, can't be, impossible, etc. So
Type 21s were?
That was the electro boat, the one that would make 18 knots underwater, and had six tubes forward. They built a bunch of them, but like I say, only one exists now, and it's on display in Bremerhaven. We got a nice overview of the city, an aerial view from the city hall. They're very helpful, and we found where this ruined bunker was, and we had to walk through the Reeperbahn where all the naked hookers were waving at us through the windows, and we got a boat that dropped us off on this rickety old dock across the Elbe River, and it was like a military op. We had to go ducking through rail yards and hiding whenever we'd hear voices or cars, penetrated security at this shipyard, and found an entry into the bunker and got inside, and nobody could see us.
You were the first to get in there then in quite a while, perhaps.
Right, 1988. Myself and Eddie Paul Phillips, member number 220.
You took that picture?
No, one of our guys did.
And why are the boats chewed up on the top?
Well, we found out that this was part of a shipyard, Hoboldwerke. And sometimes when they needed some pieces of steel, the workmen would go down there and torch them off.
They parted them out.
Yeah, years and years before. And we got there, and you couldn't see anything except water. There was water down in this bunker. And we were at high tide. Well, they've got a 12-foot tide range there. So we sat there and watched as the tide went out, and it looked like these boats were surfacing.
So, how eerie.
Yeah, I was up on the wall from where this picture was taken, shooting down there, and all of a sudden I saw some guy walking on the middle boat, U-2505, and I yelled at Eddie. I said, Eddie, there's some dummy on the boat down there. Eddie yells up, that's me, come on down. And there was a big pile of junk at the end of the bunker, and I climbed down there, and I walked on the deck of that boat also, 2505. And the one on the outside, U-3506, I checked back, and that was the boat of Gerd Tater, who was a very dear friend of mine over there. So next time I was at his house, I said, Gerd, I found your old boat, U-3506. He says, yeah, in the bunker Elba 2, right? I said, yeah.
That's funny.
Did you know it was there? He says, yes, I left it there. We scuttled it in that bunker.
Oh.
I said, well, why didn't you tell me it was in there? And he says, well, you didn't ask. Okay. Well, unfortunately, now we do have a videotape of this. Tape, not a tape, a DVD. DVD number five of us going in and You can see all these boats, these three boats, etc., on the DVD, DVD number 5. But you can't see them anymore. There had been a long-running battle between the federal German government and the government of Hamburg. Each one wanted these boats taken out of the public possibility. And the federal government says, well, it's your city, Hamburg. You got to take care of it. And Hamburg's saying, there's ordnance on board. That makes it a federal problem. Basically, what each one was saying was, I don't want to spend the money to take care of it. Well, finally, where the photographer is standing here to take the picture is about 20 feet above the boat. And eventually, the shipyard closed and moved to another town. And this place was empty, and people could get in there. And there were signs all over, you know, saying, stay out, danger, etc. Well, one guy fell, and he landed into all that busted-up steel. He fell 20 feet.
Oh.
And it incapacitated him to where he couldn't do anything, and then the tide came up, and he drowned. So somebody, I don't know whether it was the federal government or the city or I don't know, maybe money fell out of the sky, but they filled this bunker with sand, covered over the submarines with sand. Then they blew up what remained of the bunker. Then they paved over the top of it, and it's now a container terminal with those three boats forever entombed inside.
Any of the other bunkers still around? Were any of them cleaned up and made museums, so to speak?
In Germany, not to my knowledge. In
France?
Oh, definitely in France. In Norway, from what I understand, they have put concrete floors over the ocean part of it and turned them into little businesses. You want to rent a place for your business, you can rent out a bunker. In France, they had 5 on the Atlantic coast. Bordeaux, which was the 12th flotilla up the Gironde River, I think they've just walked away from those. And the same with La Rochelle. I think they've just walked away from those. But Saint-Nazaire, which is where they did all the bunker shots for the movie Das Boot, that has been turned into a tourist attraction.
Huh.
Lorient, the biggest of all, we've visited there several times with our tours. But at that time, it was still run by the French Navy, and we have a very good rapport with the French Navy, and we were allowed inside, etc. But the last time we were there, which was quite some years ago, all these gigantic, huge bunkers were cocooned in red nylon tennis net because chunks were falling off. And remember, these things were 7 meters thick, which is 23, 24 feet thick, steel-reinforced concrete, the walls and the ceiling and the roofs.
Wow.
So they're starting to come apart. And if the top is like 70, 80 feet high, and if a piece of concrete the size of your fist comes off and falls down 70
sure,
feet and hits you in the head,
it's like a coconut. You're gone.
You're going to be out of
now,
the world.
Now, it's amazing that when you figure 21 feet rebar reinforced concrete, that concrete is still curing after 50 years, you'd think that they wouldn't fall apart. But I guess the salt air has something to do with that.
Oh yeah, I used to live on my boat in the Bahamas for some years. Anything built out of concrete with steel in it, it's just not permanent. It's not forever. Because the sea air is not very friendly. And there have been rumors, I don't know how true it is, but there have been rumors that they have been using salt water to mix the concrete.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to get very long life out of that. So that's Lorient.
They were formidable buildings, though, when they were first done and in service. I mean, the RAF, the Americans could drop bombs on them and it wouldn't get through.
Well, on top of them, not only was it 7 meters thick steel-reinforced concrete, but they had huge slabs of concrete that were about 6 inches thick by about 3 feet wide by about 12 feet long.
Shock absorbers.
That's right, set on top of supports.
Yep.
And they never penetrated that, and they couldn't skip bomb into it because the Germans sank some ships 100 or so yards out from the entrance of the bunker, so you couldn't skip bombs in there. Now, Brest is still run by the French Navy. They don't use it for their nuclear boats. They're on an island, but they use it for the torpedo school, the mine sweepers, etc. But those roofs were only 6 meters thick, and they dropped some, 12-ton tall boy bombs, which were armor-piercing, and one or two did actually penetrate, and there's a collapsed part of a ceiling, and they sent a diver down some years ago, and they found the stainless steel nose of the bomb, and they've got it in a little cage there on the wall of the bunker. We were in there the first time in 1988, and we had a couple of U-boat veterans with us, and one guy, Jerry Richter, he pointed at this one slip. He says, "My boat was here. That was U-81 under Gutenberg." He said, "My boat was in this very slip just before we went into the Mediterranean and sank the carrier HMS Ark Royal." And the other guy, Detlev Zimmerman, said, "My boat was in here too." He says, I can't stay in here." And he left. And all the signs in German were still on the wall where it said that you could only drive the tugs 10 kilometers an hour, et cetera, and all the signs.
And that's still there today?
It was last time we were there, and there was no plans to take it away.
Well, they shouldn't.
No, it's
I mean, there's nothing wrong with preserving history.
I agree, except, of course, you have to tear down the old stars and bars. You can't have that. That's horrible stuff.
Horrible. Those flags, those Confederate flags, are truly, truly evil. I sent you a whole bunch of pictures. What they've done is taken the hand sign for love, corrupted it in some cases by leaving the thumb out, and in many other cases the thumb is folded in, and they just have the old hook'em horns.
Oh, yeah.
You'll see. And the people using it are not using them accidentally. From popes to presidents.
At any rate, where the heck were we? I've lost track of where I was.
Well, we were just talking about the one where they're still in German on the walls. We have to take a break here, so hold on.
Yep.
We'll come right back and continue. Fascinating photos from Harry, and we'll take a look at a most interesting seaplane that has perhaps one of the most interesting heritages of all. Next.
You remember that story?
I certainly do. Okay, I'm back with Harry, and hit the front page at Rents and look under Guests, and we're looking at image number 5 and now number 6,
right,
which is a drawing of a very unusual seaplane flying over the Baltic, the North Sea, who knows, I don't know where it
right.
is.
Right, that's not modern technology, that was an old one, it was the Blumenvoss BV-138. Which was nicknamed the Flying Wooden Shoe for obvious reasons.
Yeah. It had three engines on it.
Three engines, and they were all diesels, which is weird for an airplane.
Now, that has always kind of knocked me over. How a diesel can crank up the RPMs quickly to sustain the necessary velocity to push a plane into the air. It's just you think of a diesel as slow and ponderous and.
Right, and I think these were also slow and ponderous, but once you got it into the air, from what I understand from some of the pilots I talked to,
probably run forever.
They run forever. They hated them on the water because it took forever to get them up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
But once they got in the air, they could run forever on those diesels.
Mm.
And as you know, the unique story about one particular flying wooden shoe was that it landed on the lake by Berlin. As the Russians were closing the ring around Berlin, and there was fire going on all over the place, and they took...
Had to be a nighttime landing.
I forget what it was. We had that in the magazine maybe about a year ago we ran the story.
Mm-hmm.
But they took about a dozen passengers on board, and my number one agent, who we call Pizarro, gave me the whole story. But Pizarro stopped short of telling me who all was on the airplane that got flown out of there. And they picked up ground fire, and they got holes shot in the airplane, but nobody got hit. So
it's amazing.
Who knows who was on board? I'll be meeting with Pizarro again shortly. As you know, I'm going to Europe.
Yeah. If number one was on board, that was, you talk about getting out of a situation by the skin of your teeth, waiting to the last minute to be poisoned by Borman, and then taken out, and then got, I guess, back up on your feet. We don't know. We can only imagine. But
yeah, I'm pretty sure number one was not on board, but other high-ranking people were, because number one was already gone. He was gone at least by the 23rd of April, because that's the last order that Hitler signed was 22nd or 23rd of April. After mm-hmm. that, all the orders were signed by Bormann, because Hitler was already gone.
Got it.
But this Blumenbus BV 138 took some people out of there. We don't know who yet, but I've come across another very important asset,
mm-hmm.
A man who lives in Europe, who has dug in very deeply into this also and has a lot of documents that I'll be seeing when I'm over there after our tour. And then I'm going down to South America. I'm supposed to be in South America right now, but we had nothing but trouble with translators. The first one, we made an agreement, and 2 weeks later he comes back and says, no, my girlfriend just had a baby. I need twice as much money. So I said, well, goodbye. The next one fizzled out. The third one also wanted more money. The fourth one was a German tank commander from the new Bundeswehr, and he could speak German real well, but he couldn't speak Spanish very well. So I need somebody in. There were a whole lot of new contacts down there that we were just developing. And, you know, with only a week to spare before I was supposed to leave, there were so many untied strings.
You've got a trip waiting, a good trip.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be in Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay in mm-hmm. January and February.
Wow.
We have plenty of time to plan it and get it organized.
Mm-hmm.
And
that'll be open to some folks going along with you?
That's correct. And they can get information. Just send me an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net. And I know there are some people who are listening right now who are going to say, well, damn it, I asked for that information. Well, it's not up yet.
uh-huh.
We'll be posting it shortly.
Yeah.
And we're going to Europe middle September. We're going over there, late September. And we have a small group, room for more if they want. We're going to be visiting the historic places in Munich, also in Nuremberg, then down to southern Austria. And we participate in the memorial on Ulrich's Mountain, where they remember everyone who fell in battle, no matter what
yeah.
uniform, no matter what flag.
You know, I often make a point to make note of the valor and the dignity that most Germans in the military tried to bring to that awful, dreadful profession
yeah.
or patriotic duty. But certainly this is not to, for a second, exclude any Americans or British or any Russian, even Soviets, who fought with the same kind of dedication and fearless heroism for their cause. We don't differentiate here. However, what we do is try to present the side that has intentionally been covered up, buried, and made verboten to talk about.
Yeah.
Because those men and women deserve their day in the sun, too.
That's, excuse me, yeah, that is the one thing that I am the most proud of, that these old German veterans who were relegated to keeping quiet, and they had their clubs, their U-Boot-Kameradschaft, they call them, in the major cities, and
sure.
they meet in nondescript places. It's not like, well, I belong to the American Legion, and the Legion post uptown here has a Huey helicopter sitting out front and the flags flying. You can't do that in Germany. You can't even advertise that you've got a veterans association.
Mm-hmm.
The one we go to in Klagenfurt, Austria, is in a converted coal bin in the basement. So,
Well, it's too bad. That's Zionism, though. And Germany has been under the thumb, the boot of Zionism since the war.
Well, before. But, you know, I look back on some of it when Hess, the youngest combat commander who saw heavy combat, 21-year-old kid, commander of a submarine, he and quite a few of the others came over to one of our conventions we had in Key Largo. We took everybody out on an airboat and chasing alligators, and these guys had a wonderful time, and they met with some of their former enemies, and they were drinking with each other, and they got to be buddies, and we put the smile back on their face, and so many of them have told me that that gave them, that put the epaulets back on their shoulders. And
well, that's nice to hear.
That's really the thing I'm most proud of. That and as you know, I don't take a salary. Nobody in Shark Hunters takes a salary. And I put
You're not a front agency for any neo anything group. So
no.
Unlike the Spitlickers and all the others that are pertinent to that, they're all on salaries. And unfortunately, it comes from the American taxpayer.
Yeah, they bring in, I looked at their P&Ls for 2013. They brought in like $40 million.
Yep.
And here I sit with my 1987 Suburban with over 300,000 miles on it in the shop because the engine just crapped out.
Well, I have a 1997 something or another, so there we go. All right, we'll be right back. Hold on, Harry. We'll take
a little
break. Harry Cooper and I will continue. I hope you're having fun with us. We always enjoy these visits mutually, and you are invited each time. Back in a minute. Okay, and back with Harry. Let's go back to the photos, the images there, and take a look at number 7. For those of you who have not seen this aircraft before, yes, that is a World War II twin jet engine bomber.
Yep.
That was in operation at the end of the war. It was a German bomber, the Arado.
Yep.
Was it
234.
And, obviously a superior aircraft for a number of reasons. Just the first one, it was almost a beta version, but they used it. And then they, at first it had skids, then they added wheels. The technology was just exploding, if you can just imagine what it was like on the drawing boards, where they were just pushing and pushing and pushing. Time. They just needed more time to try to even the playing field.
We brought two of them over here to the U.S. after the war to test them.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
One of our members, I can't remember his last name. It'll come to me in a minute. Colonel Robert, he was the test pilot, and he was also the B-29 pilot that took Chuck Yeager up in the Bell X-1 and dropped him off.
Yeah. What did he say about the 234?
He thought it was great, and from what I understand, I don't know if this is fact, but they just, when they were done with the testing and all that, they just shoved it into the river there.
And, where?
I'm not sure. Probably by D.C., but...
How stupid. The Potomac?
I don't know, but it, whatever river it
well,
is...
Well, it should be pulled out, given to the Smithsonian, and they can as long as the frame is there, that's all they need.
Yeah.
They can rebuild it.
Well, they brought over one of the very unique U-boats, U-1105, which was a standard Type 7C, but it was all coated in rubber to try to defeat ASDIC and sonar. First coating had scientifically shaped and spaced holes. The second layer of rubber was to make it slide through the water more easily. They even had rubber riveted to the propeller blades. And they brought it over into, I think it was the Potomac, and they slung a new type depth charge underneath the belly and detonated it from shore to see what damage it would do. And the boat, of course, broke in half, and it settled in the mud. And now they, about 10, 15 years ago, they created a memorial park on the river bank, but I mean the submarine is gone. It's under the mud. They got rid of so much. some 300 U-boats were surrendered into British held ports in Northern Ireland, and they, except for a handful that were handed out to the French and the Norwegians, mm-hmm. the rest were all hauled out and scuttled in the, allegedly in the deep water off of northwest of Ireland, but some of them never made it out that far. They foundered and sank, some in 100 feet of water, and they've been dived. So, mm-hmm. you know, I guess they were just in a rush to get rid of everything.
Yeah. All right, picture number 8 is the legendary, never to be forgotten, Messerschmitt.
The ME-262.
And most incredible breakthrough. I talked once to a B-17. He was a pilot or he was a gunner. I can't remember which. He said that they weren't even told about these planes.
Let it be a surprise.
They didn't know. And he said he saw them. They went by so fast they could not believe it.
Oh, these things ran almost 600 miles an
yeah.
hour, and the B-17s, B-29s, they were only making
175, 200 knots.
Right, and these things were 400 miles an hour faster than them. They went
yeah.
by like a streak. They were 100 miles an hour faster than the P-51.
Yeah, no, they just...
They were only vulnerable during takeoff and landing when
yeah.
they had to slow down.
Which is really kind of a... We used to have a word CS, chicken way of shooting your enemy down when they're vulnerable. You do it
yeah.
with a little bit of class. You fight them in the air, you don't fight them.
Well, sometimes, you know, whether it's right, wrong, or otherwise, the first rule of war is to win. The second rule is to win honorably, but if you can't win honorably, you revert back to rule number one, win
right.
at all costs.
Look at number 9, the 160, I can't, the
163.
Comet.
163.
163, I was right. 163 at, comet heading up with two other comets left of it toward a formation of B-17s, most
yeah,
likely.
The bomber stream, they call that, the bomber stream.
Yeah.
And that one is signed by the first guy to ever fly the ME-163, Wolfgang Späthe, who was a member of Shark Hunters until he died. Nice man. We wrote back and forth quite a bit. And incidentally, if any of your listeners would like a copy of the magazine, they just send me an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net and say they would like a copy. And we'll send it electronically, no charge, no obligation. And incidentally, to the listeners who have already sent in orders during the time we're on the show for the book, first, thank you very much. Secondly, I'm not going to answer your emails tonight. I'm going to bed when this is over.
Yeah.
But first thing in the morning, you'll get your confirmation, and first thing in the week, your books will go out. Hand-signed,
nice.
Of course, by me, which makes them worth about half what they would have been worth otherwise.
Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah, but these comets, the ME-163,
mm-hmm.
they were just the hottest thing in the sky. They were even 100 miles an hour faster than the jet fighters.
Yeah. Also, they're the most dangerous thing in the sky for the pilots. They
yeah.
had two tanks of highly volatile liquids, and they'd, I forget, the B stuff and the T stuff or something, and they'd mix them, and it would create an incredible reaction and propel the plane up, straight up.
Yeah. At warp factor 12, I guess, if
yeah.
you remember the old Star Trek flick. Yeah, they were ass kickers, but they were hard to land because I think they were all dead stick landings. They all were flew around until they ran
Correct.
Out of fuel.
Correct. They coasted in.
Yeah. And dead stick landings are not always the hot setup. You know, it can too many things go wrong. But Wolfgang Späthe was an ace. He had over, I think he had 101 kills, not all with his rocket plane. He was flying prop jobs before that. But that's another thing in our monthly magazine. We list the aces. We just finished in the magazine that's going to go out in the next few days, KTB 273, we list all the fighter pilots in all the air forces that had 20 kills. And the list is getting slimmer and slimmer. When you list the aces with 5 kills, it took us several issues to do that. Now, in one issue, we can list everybody with 20 kills. And when we get up to 60-something kills, that Ivan Kunjadov, the highest-scoring Soviet fighter pilot, after that, it's all Germans.
Ending with Eric Hartmann.
Eric Hartmann, who was also a member of Shark Hunters.
Yeah.
352 confirmed. And Barkhorn was the second highest with 302. And Gunter Rall, the third, with 275. He was also a member of Shark Hunters. I spent a day with him in his house. What a fun guy. He had a sense of humor. He showed me his hand with one thumb missing. And he said, Hub Zemke's fighters shot off my thumb and they saved my life. I said, what are you talking about? He says, he had a twinkle in his eye and perfect English. He said, I was diving on two of Hub Zemke's thunderbolts and I was shooting them down, but two of his thunderbolts was diving on me and they were shooting on my airplane and my engine was on fire and they shot off my thumb and they saved my life. I said, General, you're not making sense. What the hell are you talking about? And he smiled. He says, I jumped out mit mein Schirm, my parachute. Mm-hmm. And when I got through the ground, if I still had my thumb, the Luftwaffe would say, get another plane, go up and die. So they saved my life. So he...
Too funny.
Yeah, he passed away just a few years ago, but what a fun guy. And spoke perfect English, and he signed some of our prints. You know, we have hand-signed prints that are signed by these wonderful veterans, mostly German vets, but also the American...
Yeah. I have a bunch of those. They're art. They're not photo prints. I have a bunch of those, which I don't know if you would want to make them available, some of your people or not, but they're beautifully drawn. Just the drawing and the painting on them, amazing. Okay, last image real quick, number 10.
Yeah, this one is going to get everybody's attention. That's the Horton. You're familiar with the Horton?
Horton Brothers.
Yeah, that's right. That's
a flying wing.
Yeah. Which allegedly was used as a mock or something for our B-2 stealth bomber. And this was a stealth bomber, a flying wing, developed in Germany by the Horton Brothers. The interesting thing, it's flying over the Brazilian rainforest in this picture.
Now, that's very interesting. And what does that tell you about the Horton brothers and where they went after the war?
Yeah, well, that was another thing. I got, when I was down there just last year, I met this historian for the Argentine Air Force. Just nice fella, very nice man. And he gave me all sorts of goodies to bring home. One of them was a DVD of the aircraft of the Argentine Air Force of 1960.
Yeah.
And they had a camera on the set up on a tripod, and the airplanes were taxiing by, and you're watching them and all that. And all of a sudden, I see a Horton flying wing taxiing past me. And I'm thinking, what the heck? So I call him up. I said, where the hell did you guys get a Horton? He says, oh, the Horton brothers came down here to Argentina. They were designing airplanes for us.
Amazing.
Yeah.
There, if you do this, folks, get a pen real quick. And just do a simple Google or Yahoo or any search engine. Do a search for H-O-229. H-O, like Ho, 229. And that's Horton 229.
There's
that's
a dash the one. There. Are you Horton, there? H-O-229.
There you go. It'll come up either way, but H-O-229. Look at the images. There's one of them at Silver Hill, I think it is, of the Smithsonian. They did say they brought three over here, I think. One of them flew, one of them crashed, killed a test pilot. But this plane was stealth. It had everything. It was an extraordinary achievement aerodynamically. The Horton's ultimate at that time accomplishment. HO-229. Look at the pictures and prepare to be amazed if you haven't seen them.
Don't forget to check sharkhunters.com.
There you go.
Yeah, this Horton came out in 1944.
Yeah.
They were way advanced with just about everything.
Way. There are photographs of it in flight. I think there may be some movies of it somewhere in flight, but we have so much German, I guess I could call it military memorabilia, in storage here that we haven't released. Who knows if we will. It's so stupid. It's just history. What are they afraid of, you know?
Good question.
What in the heck are they afraid of? Harry, thank you. Go get some rest. You're always just a great guest, and we have so much fun, and we always learn, and thank you.
Well, thanks, pal, and I'm going to bed now. You have fun on the rest of your show.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. Good night. Harry Cooper of SharkHunters.com, and by all means, stop by and take a look. Look at the Horton, HO-229, and prepare to be amazed. World War II. It actually flew, and 6 more months it would have been operational with squadrons of them, and they were ready to build. Just amazing. All right, we'll be back with more in just a few.